What is going on, New York Rangers fans, and welcome to episode 23 of the New Ice City Podcast. I'm your host, Vincent Mercogliano of the USA Today Network, a.k.a. The Flying V. Bet you guys didn't think you'd hear that one again, but you did. And we are back for a very special episode. I feel like I say this every week, but I've been really happy about the way the show has been coming together lately. And that's because our guest this week is someone who I have been watching my whole life. I'm sure a lot of you will probably say the same when you hear the name. And that is, from ESPN, a longtime SportsCenter anchor, a very passionate NHL fan, a very passionate Rangers fan, and that is Linda Cohn. Linda is a big hockey advocate, and I'm sure a lot of you probably know that she's a huge New York Rangers fan. Her and I have been in touch a little bit lately. We follow each other on Twitter, that sort of thing. And I reached out to her because I thought it'd be really fun to have her on and talk about her career path. I found out recently that she was actually the first full-time sports anchor on television in the U.S. She started in 1987, the same year I was born. And Linda's obviously gone on to have a tremendous career with ESPN. And like I said, she's a huge hockey fan. So we talk some Rangers. We talk about her playing days. She played for SUNY Oswego as a female goalie, but actually played on her boys' team while she was in high school. So we go over all that stuff with Linda. Really fun interview with her. But first, we of course have to get to the news of the day. And I started today, Wednesday, March 10th, writing about the Rangers' fourth line, actually. That's what I spent my time doing this morning. I was kind of assessing who should be the healthy scratch as we move forward here, because it's kind of been a debate in the last few days. We've seen the Rangers try out a few different guys as far as who's been going to the press box, and it's kind of been an interesting topic of conversation, I thought, that I wanted to address. But then all of a sudden, as has happened several times already this season, my phone starts blowing up, and get the news that Artemi Panarin is back on the ice with the Rangers. I immediately log on to Twitter and see that they had posted a video of Panarin walking onto the ice practicing with the team in Boston. And it turned into a whirlwind of a day. I can say that for sure. We didn't get a chance to speak to Panarin, and I'll touch on that in a second. But we did get a chance to speak to David Quinn and a couple of his teammates. And they are making it clear, as they really have from the beginning, that they are, the quote was, fully in his corner. It sounds like the players have been in touch with Panarin. They've heard his side of the story. They did not seem overly concerned at all, and they said plenty of things backing up his character. We heard today from Jacob Trouba and Ryan Lindgren, but we've also heard this from Chris Kreider and Ryan Strom, a number of other guys, including former KHL teammates of Panarin. So we know that the feeling among those who have played with Panarin is that they do not feel that these allegations are credible, and the Rangers are continuing with that stance. We were told by Jacob Trouba that the day started where they had kind of heard whispers from people around the team that Panarin might be joining them at some point in Boston. They have games against the Bruins on Thursday and Saturday. And then they were having breakfast on Wednesday morning, and all of a sudden, who walks through the doors but Panarin? And it sounds like that was a pretty cool moment for the team. And so now they move ahead with Panarin back in the fold. David Quinn told us that he will not play in Thursday night's 7 p.m. game against the Bruins. He just had his first practice with the team on Wednesday. Quinn said he wants to make sure that he is in a position to succeed when they do put him back in the lineup. We know that Panarin did some skating during his leave of absence, but from what Quinn said today, it didn't sound like he's been on the ice all that much. So I had a feeling they might want to ease him in, but my gut tells me Saturday seems like a pretty logical game for him to return for. That's a 1 o'clock afternoon game. And if he's going to go up there to join the team in Boston, it makes sense that he would play at least in one of the two games. So I would expect to see him in the lineup on Saturday, but again, that's unconfirmed. We'll have to wait and see on that. There were a lot of questions today for Quinn and teammates, and I think it was something that had to be addressed, about the allegations themselves. Now, listen, at this point, I've made so many calls on this, and there's been so much reporting, not just from myself, but from a lot of other people surrounding this story. We have many reasons to believe that this story from Panarin's former KHL coach was fabricated with shady motives. We have not found really anybody else who's backing up these claims. We've heard from former teammates, including Panarin's former roommate, who the coach said was there on that night, and he basically said that there was nothing violent, there was no blows, was the direct quote. There was nothing that he said that would back up Nazarov's claims that Panarin assaulted this 18-year-old woman. We also know that we've heard from the Latvian authorities that there is no police report on record about this alleged incident. We know that the KHL has come out and said that they were not aware of any incident with Panarin in 2011, which is when Nazarov allegedly said that it happened. So right now, the only person really backing this story up is Nazarov himself, and we've heard all kinds of character concerns about him. So listen, with where we're at right now, I feel pretty confident that, you know, maybe there was some kind of a verbal confrontation between some players and a group of young women that night. Panarin's teammate basically said that, you know, there were a couple of phrases exchanged or whatever he said. He said at the very most, maybe there was a push, but he said that he couldn't even verify that, and he didn't even really believe that that necessarily happened. But he was very adamant that there was no assault, no blows, no punches, nothing like that. So right now, we all feel pretty confident that Panarin did not do what he is being accused of doing that night. I will say this, at some point, Panarin needs to address the situation. We all feel pretty confident, based on the reporting that we've done, that, you know, his name should be cleared, and that this was a fabricated thing, unfounded, uncorroborated, all that stuff. But I think it's important for him to address the media at some point and speak directly to these accusations and speak directly to why he felt that it was necessary for him to take this leave of absence. The Rangers didn't make him available today. I'm really hoping that they do sometime in the next few days. We'll wait and see. But at some point, he's going to need to talk about it. We're obviously going to have questions for him, and hopefully that will happen sooner than later. As for what it means for the Rangers, well, quite clearly it means they're getting their best player back and they can really use him right now. They were riding pretty high. They actually weathered the storm for the most part without Panarin. Before they played these last two games in Pittsburgh, they had won 6 out of 8, which I think a lot of people would have been surprised about had we told you when Panarin went out that they would go on that kind of a run. But they lost 2 in a row to the Penguins. Those are stinging losses, no doubt about it, because they went to Pittsburgh trailing the Penguins by only 4 points in the standings, and then they left Pittsburgh trailing by 8 points. So they lost a lot of ground in a span of 3 days. And the first game, they really didn't have much of a chance in. But the second game, the score was close. They cut it to 3-2 in the third period. They played really well in the third period. And Tristan Jarry made some incredible saves, especially on Booch in those last couple minutes. So the Rangers felt like they had a chance to win that one, and they were definitely frustrated that they didn't. I've seen some of the doom and gloom and some of the panic. I know, you know, every loss elicits some huge reaction from the Twitter crowd. I've come to expect it. It's no surprise. But at the same time, if we're being realistic, we know, and I've repeated this over and over again, that coming into the season, the Rangers looked like they would be sixth in the pecking order in this division, and it would be a slog of a schedule for them to get through, and especially when they're playing without Panarin against teams like the Penguins, wins are going to be hard to come by. So I definitely don't think that this is unexpected that they lost both games to Pittsburgh, but it nonetheless stings because of the position that they're in, where we're creeping up on the halfway point of the season, and the Rangers right now are definitely on the outside of the playoff picture looking in. So getting Panarin back, we'll see what that means for them. Does it provide a boost? Does it provide a spark? It should to some degree, but what it really needs to mean is that the Rangers string some wins together, because if they're going to make this interesting, as we talked about on last week's program, it's reaching make-or-break territory, where they got to rattle off another 6 out of 8 here and get themselves back into this race if they really want to be taken seriously in the second half of the season. Now, I wrote about, just before I started recording this podcast, I took some time to write what I think Panarin's return will mean for the lineup. And I basically think there's one core question that Quinn needs to answer on his own, and then that will kind of dictate what happens with the rest of the lineup. And that's, which center does he want to play Panarin with? We know that for the most part of the last 2 years, the answer to that question has been Ryan Strome. They had that great run together last season. They were together for 13 of the 14 games that Panarin has played this season. But the one game that they weren't together was the last game that Panarin played. That was on February 20th, a 4-1 win over the Washington Capitals. And that is when Quinn finally made the decision the decision that a lot of us had been kind of asking about and wondering when he was going to do it, and that was to put Panarin on that top line with Mika Zibanejad. It worked out well for that one game, and if it were me, and again, I'm not the coach of the team here, but if it were me, as I wrote today, I think that that's the way that I would like to see them go, because if there's anybody who's going to help Zibanejad get out of this season-long funk that he's been in, it's Panarin. So if I were Quinn, I would like to see if you can give them an extended look together, see what that does for Mika, see what that does for his confidence, let Panarin do his thing on that top line, put your two best players, most talented players together. The right wing on that line would probably be Booch in this situation. Booch actually leads the team in scoring right now with 20 points. He's been on a hot streak, five-game point streak going on right now for him. So that would be my top line. The second line, I really think, and I got some numbers today to back this up that might surprise you guys, but I really think that I would be inclined to keep Chris Kreider with Ryan Strome on that second line. They've been together for 9 games now. They've produced 23 points combined. That's 12 for Kreider and 11 for Strome. So both of them have been highly productive in these last 9 games. I think I would keep riding those hot hands together. And then Kaapo Kakko is your logical choice as the right wing on that second line. And then the third line, you know, that means with Panarin coming back, one of the guys who's in the top six right now has to be the odd man out. I'm sure some of you are going to be disappointed if it ends up being Alexis Lafreniere who drops to the third line. But I think it makes a lot of sense because you can't justify taking Kreider out of the top six right now with the way that he's been playing. Obviously, Panarin is going to be in the top six. And your other option is move Lafreniere to the right wing, which you know is in his natural position. I'd rather keep Booch and Kakko in the top six in their natural right wing positions and then move Lafreniere down to the third line. And then in that situation, you can reunite that line that we saw for all of training camp, but then only lasted 1 game in the regular season with Lafreniere, Philip Hedl, and Julien Gauthier, who's been playing much better lately. His ice time is going up. Clearly, he's earning more of Quinn's trust. I think he's been one of their better forwards in the last couple games. So that's the way that I would play it. We'll see what Quinn does. I don't think we're going to have an answer on that until at least Friday because we know Panarin's not playing Thursday. But go check out that story at lohud.com/sports/Rangers to see what I think a little more in-depth about how the line should be arranged with Panarin coming back. Again, that's a subscriber-only story, so I will remind everyone again that I am incredibly grateful for those of you who have subscribed in the last couple weeks, last couple months. Our numbers have really jumped, and I very much appreciate it. And we are still offering subscriptions right now, $1 for the first 3 months. So if you need a link or you have any questions, reach out and ask. But I definitely appreciate everybody who has joined in. And as I mentioned a couple weeks ago on the program, you're going to see at least one of these subscriber-only stories per week where you need to be a subscriber to be able to read them. So the importance of that is crucial, and I appreciate everybody who's been able to do it so far. With that, I got a lot of interesting questions from you guys this week that we'll get to in the Twitter question portion of the program on the back end. But first, I want to get to this interview with Linda Cohn, which I think you guys are going to enjoy. So here's Linda. And now let's welcome into the program a guest who I am very excited to have on this week, someone who I've known for a long time as a passionate Rangers fan, a passionate hockey fan. Many of you will know her from ESPN. She hosts In the Crease on ESPN+. You can also hear her on Sirius XM Mad Dog Radio on the weekend. And that, of course, is Linda Cohn. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Vince.
I appreciate it. You're somebody, I hope you don't take offense to this, but you're somebody I've been watching my whole life. So it's definitely a pleasure and a thrill to have you on today.
Yeah, I never take offense to that. It's a compliment, right? I mean, it really is. Anyone to think that's offensive is nuts. It reminds me of like when I first started way back when on, even before I, joined ESPN way back in 1992, you know, before that I was working in New York radio, filling in wherever I could, working in local cable TV, you know, on Long Island and stuff like that. And, I remember people always saying, you know, especially, you know, men, young men saying, you know, you're the first woman I ever listened and, you know, got my sports from. And that's great. Like it was compliment. They always would say, don't take it the wrong way, you know, and I'd be like, are you kidding me? That's like the greatest compliment, you know, and that's how it was back in the day, you know, when you get a compliment, you know, from a guy saying how great you are giving them sports reports and all this stuff, this was like better than a bouquet of flowers in my business and what I was trying to do and win people over and just let people know that I'm a fan just like them, you know, of my teams and of sports.
Well, I actually read this earlier that you were the first full-time female sports anchor in the U.S. And you kind of just touched on it a little bit, but I've always wondered, some people, they might not want to be singled out in that way or labeled for that, but it sounds like that's something that you definitely take pride in.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, that was like my radio work. I was the first full-time female, you know, radio sports anchor when I started working at ABC Radio Network. You know, there were just a handful of women in TV sports before me, and they were all amazing and really broke ground. But I'm always flattered, and I realize the impact I made. Of course, I realize it much later in my life, because when you're in it, you're just, you know, you're thinking about the next level and you're on the treadmill of just trying to get better and be better and do this assignment or do this. Like, you're climbing the mountain, right, in your head of, you know, you're not thinking about who you're impacting. But, you know, joining SportsCenter like I did in 1992 and instantly, you know, being a anchor, you know, five nights a week, that was what kind of set everything apart. When I hear from people, they're saying, I knew I could watch Linda Cohn on SportsCenter. I knew if I, you know, turned on the late SportsCenter or watched her in the re-airs early morning, which there used to be like 8-9 re-airs in the morning. When you were little, Vince, you remember
that? I remember. I remember. I used to watch them all the time.
Right, exactly. So that's how people, you know, and what's great is the fact that that's when, like, you know, young women or women watching sports with their dads, like I did growing up, you know, they saw me doing SportsCenter and they're like, wow, that's really cool. You know, and it gave young women, you know, and little girls the vision that, you know, they too could get in the business and talk about what they love most.
I was absolutely one of those kids who had SportsCenter rerunning in the morning and watching it over and over again. Yeah. So I can for sure relate. Now, you mentioned your dad. I know you grew up in Long Island, right?
Yeah.
Is he the one who made you a passionate hockey fan? Did he kind of spark your interest in the game?
Yeah, there's no question. You know, it was all like at the beginning, all my dad, he was a, you know, diehard, passionate Rangers fan. He's no longer with us. Neither is my mom, but both were instrumental in my hockey passion, especially with the Rangers. My dad would always wouldn't miss a game. We even won season tickets one year. My dad did played some kind of, I don't know, work contest. And there was a choice between Jets, Rangers, and I think it was Knicks. That's what, and he ended up winning the Jets, but he traded the guy who wanted the Jets tickets. We won the Jets. So he's like, I'll take the Rangers. And we live way out east on Long Island, but we took that 2-hour train ride on the LIRR and made almost every one of those home games that we won. So anyway, my dad just, you know, I always kid around, but I learned how to curse from my dad because watching the Rangers, you know, back in the day. It was like a love hate, not a hate, but a love like frustration while being a fan of the New York Rangers, you know, pre 1994. And so, you know, he was great. And then I wanted to play hockey and I was playing street hockey with the boys in my neighborhood. And then my mother found a league that actually accepted girls to play with boys, but I had to play with boys that were a lot younger. So I learned how to skate with goalie pads, with goalie equipment, because I always wanted to be a goalie. I thought that was like the coolest thing. And, you know, I was ready to, you know, take the heat if it didn't go well, but I'd love the adulation if I was the hero.
So, you know, you played with boys when you were like high school age, but then in college you played on at Oswego, I believe you played on the women's team.
Yeah. I mean, when this league that my mom found on Long Island, it was a place called Racket and Rink in Farmingdale. I don't think it exists anymore, but they actually had a league. And it's funny, the New York Islanders sponsored the league. So here I'm this diehard Ranger fan playing in a New York Islanders league. And back in the day, I met like Bobby Nystrom and Billy Smith and Chico Resch, and they couldn't have been nicer. But, you know, I was this like, you know, 13, 14, 15 year old girl, but I was only allowed to play with 8, 9, 10 year old boys back then. And then finally I tried out in high school for the boys team, which was a club team, but it was my high school, the boys team. I made it in my senior year. I tried out my junior year, didn't make it, but got a lot of, you know, hey, come back next year. And then I made it as the backup goaltender in my senior year, which was really great. And yeah, I didn't play And then when I picked my college, which was an amazing place, Oswego State, I picked them. One of the reasons and a big reason is because they had a girls hockey team. So yeah, that was the first time I played ice hockey with girls. And it was, you know, it was fun. It was great. Played all these great teams, Cornell, you know, all these kind of great, it was a great experience. Anyone who plays in any team, especially in college at that level, you know what it meant. You never forget it.
Do you have any favorite memories from your playing days? Maybe some glory stories you can share?
Well, it's funny. One of my greatest memories is when I was a freshman and I played Cornell University, and the women's team could beat most men's teams. And, you know, there I was, our team was basically, you know, let's just put it this way, not as highly skilled, mm-hmm. you know, as like Cornell. So, but I remember my parents actually drove up from Long Island and watched me play for the first time as a member of Oswego State. And remarkably, I had one of my best games. And I say remarkably because I was left on an island, and I'm not blaming my teammates, but that's how good this team was. I mean, every odd man rush, every time they had a shot on goal, it was an odd man rush or a breakaway. So I ended up like stopping about 65 shots, but I let in 16. So they had over 80 shots on goal on me. So
wow,
it was really memorable, but my parents were watching. But it was really, I'm telling you though, I did have some dazzling saves, believe it or not.
Well, I don't care how many shots you face. 65 saves is a lot of saves for one game. So
yeah, for sure.
So then in college or even earlier, did you always know you wanted to go into broadcasting, or how did that unfold from there?
Well, when I picked the college, Oswego State, they had a great communication studies program, broadcasting concentrate. And, you know, my dreams of being a pro hockey player, they weren't there. There was no women's Olympics, you know, hockey in the Olympics. There was really no hope, nothing like that. So I knew I wanted sports to be something. I wanted to get into sports and broadcasting. You know, that's what I wanted. I wanted to at least have sports in my world, you know, post-college. So, you know, I picked a college that had great communication studies program, and that really helped me. And I got some internship, and internship was the key. And then you just kind of dig and dig. And I really owe it to the late Ed Ingalls, who was a legend, a giant at WCBS AM radio. He gave me my first big opportunity in sports. He put me on the radio. I did weekend sports updates. They were repeated over and over again. You know, I'd come into New York City late at night, drive in, tape these sports reports when all the games were over, and they would run overnight and in the morning. It was sort of like a prelude to what I did for SportsCenter when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time a woman was heard regularly on, you know, on the radio in New York City and surrounding areas, WCBS AM. That was before WFAN. So you have to remember, back in the day, pre-sports talk radio, that's how people were getting their sports, at least via radio. You know, and I also did some, that was my first big break. And I also just would freelance. I mean, I worked 7 days a week at seven different places, to seven different radio stations, just doing sports, filling in. I worked at a thing called Sports Phone, which was based in New York City, where, again, back in the day, pre-sports talk radio, you'd go in this little room and you'd say the scores every, you know, 5 minutes and keep updating scores. And of course it was aimed for bettors, you know, even back then before there were sports books and, you know, what betting is now in sports, but stuff like that, you know, I did what I had to do to keep, you know, keep my hands in sports. And then I always was intrigued about TV, but I didn't know if I could pull that off. And my big break there was making a lot of my breaks, like making, I wrote a book about this called Conehead back in 2008, just there's a laugh out loud at my own journey, you know, laughing mm-hmm. at my own journey and what I did, you know, to get there. And I mean, from whether it was, and I'm not a cook, but I was baking cookies for the cameraman at this Long Island, you know, radio TV station. So he can make a tape of me doing sports. And then I sent that tape out to cities I would like to live in the country where I would like to do sports. And a year later, Seattle came calling. And that was my big TV break. But I made that break, right? Because I wasn't doing sports at this local Long Island cable TV station. I was doing news, you know, I was being sent down little minor news reports to get TV experience. You know, that's how I got my TV experience, by covering things that weren't, you know, sports pretty much. So anyway, that was my big break. I worked at a CBS affiliate in Seattle, Washington at that time. It was KIRO. And that's where ESPN spotted me. And first they spotted me when I first got hired in Seattle, but then I couldn't dump Seattle after I just started there, you know, and I was under contract, but then they came calling again, ESPN did. And that was in 1992. And then I'm a pretty loyal person. So even though I could have gone elsewhere, probably made a hell of a lot more money. I stayed at ESPN because I felt that was those people, especially in the early days, that they were like me, you know, sports fans, first and foremost, the people that watched.
Yeah, and that absolutely came across in watching those sports centers with the anchors, the people that I grew up watching in the 90s. Like, you could just tell that there was some real camaraderie there, and I'm sure you guys had some great experiences.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just, it was a family. It was a community. It was, you know, when your place where you have to go to work is a place called Bristol, Connecticut, and there was a lot going on, you know, you get close and, you know, we're all kind of different, but we're all the same. And it was just, it was fun. I mean, listen, ESPN has grown into something amazing and fantastic and, you know, type of thing. And I'm just glad I was, you know, a small part during the really the memorable years, you know, type of thing. And it's nice. That means a lot, you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It's very cool. And then I wanted to get back to the hockey a little bit because I was curious about this. You've talked a lot about being from Long Island and your dad was a Rangers fan. I went to Hofstra. So I spent a few, 4 years out in Long Island and kind of got to know the scene out there a little bit. I always found it weird, interesting when there were Rangers fans on the island as opposed to being Islanders fans, because obviously that's like Islanders country. So do you know how that kind of unfolded? Was your dad originally from somewhere else or?
Yeah, no, he was from somewhere else. He was from New York, but he was not from Long Island. So he was from Brooklyn and spent time in the Bronx. And my mother actually was from Massachusetts. So she just adopted whatever team my dad did. But yeah, and that was really, and it's interesting when we first moved to Long Island and I was very little, I was trying to think how old I was, but probably, I think I was 8 years old or something. I think I was. And, you know, I remember the first hockey game I listened to on the radio was like that first year of the Islanders, you know, that they existed like in 1972 or something. And I was like, I was sort of like, hey, they're from Long Island. That's where I'm from, you know, and for a while I was listening to them a lot, but they were never on TV back then. So my dad would always be watching the Rangers on TV, you know, we had like early MSG or early whatever it was on back then in the, you know, early 70s and mid 70s. And so I just wanted to spend time with my dad and watch hockey. And it was always the Rangers. And that's how I kind of gravitated toward them and didn't leave the Rangers. And, you know, it's my first real sports job was working for WALK Radio. It's a job I created. I was really a newscaster at 5 minute news updates in between, you know, adult contemporary music. And, but then I volunteered to cover the New York Islanders and make that hour drive there and back, just as long as they paid the $10 for my gas. That was the deal I made, because I knew that's how I would get experience. And so you can imagine this girl who just grew up obsessed with the Rangers. Here I was covering like great New York Islander teams. And I was like, you know, this was like in the early 80s. And, you know, I'm like, you know, that's how I really had to learn to be objective, you know, because, you know, there I am in the locker room with the Islanders and like, you know, after they just destroyed the Rangers and I had to be, you know, not upset.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have any most vivid or favorite Rangers memories over the years, either from when you were a kid or, you know, I'm sure 94, everyone points to 94, obviously, but what are some of your most vivid Rangers memories?
Well, you know, I'm old enough to have those old memories and many of them were heartbreak, as I mentioned before, 94. But it's why, like, the first goaltender I really love. I mean, I loved all Ranger goalies, you know, from, you know, I even loved Eddie Neal back in the day. I mean, you name it, you put goalie in the Ranger uniform, you know, they were great to me. Richter, of course, amazing, right? Henrik, you know, we those are all the no-brainers.
Yeah.
But my first love on the Rangers was, no question, Eddie Jokinen back in the day. Eddie was just did things his own way. He was one of the first to play the puck. He was so great with a goalie stick and he wouldn't take any crap from anybody. And I remember there was a you know, sadly, it was a sad playoff loss, but it was the first time the Rangers lost to the Islanders in that best of three overtime series when J.P. Parisi scored with 11 seconds to go, 11 seconds into overtime. I remember I was babysitting kids. I was watching this game and I called up my dad. I'm like, what just happened? You know, like, what is this supposed to happen? But anyway, in that series, you know, some people can go on YouTube and figure this out, but I was such an Eddie Jonkman fan. I didn't understand why Gilles Villamure was starting that game and they got behind 3-0 in the third and final game. And then, you know, the coach, I guess it was Emil Francis, put in Eddie Jonkman and the team rallied to tie up the game. And again, they eventually would lose in overtime, but how they rallied was Eddie started a fight just to get things going. He didn't care. He started a fight. The goaltender, Eddie Jonkman, with, you know, Gary Howlett, who was this 5'9" Islander tough guy who didn't even want to fight a goaltender, but Eddie had to get the team going. They were down 3-0. He had just came in to replace the starter and they tied up the game. And then of course they lost in overtime and there's so much heartbreak. Like I remember I was at the Nassau Coliseum back in the '80s in 1984, best of five series, playoff series with the Islanders. Ken Morrow scored the overtime goal against Glenn Hanlon. You know, Ken Morrow that year could do no wrong. I mean, he was a, you know, former, actually not that year, but, you know, he's former Olympic hero and he scores the overtime winner. And, you know, I was surrounded, I was in the press box and I really had to hide my emotions. And it was such an exciting game. Don Maloney had tied it with 33 seconds left to send it into overtime. And then the Rangers would lose in overtime. So it was a familiar script of heartbreak, usually when they were playing the Islanders. And then thank God for 94, because I got to drink from the Stanley Cup that very night. I just managed to know somebody that knew somebody. They opened the door to where the Rangers post party was right at the bottom of Madison Square Garden, this big room. And next thing I know, I was in the door. I saw the cup and, you know, people have recognized me from ESPN. So I was 2 years in to my ESPN dumb, you know, because I started in 92 and the cup was in 94 and they let me behind the ropes and they said, here. And there was like everyone, God knows how many germs, who cared? Everyone's lips were around the cup. And, you know, the players by then had their fill. They were busy partying, doing their thing. These are just the extracurricular type of people. And yeah, so it was a dream come true that night. Not only they won the cup, but I got to drink from the cup that very night. So that's probably awesome. The all-time greatest Vince Rangers moment.
I'm sure a lot of Rangers fans would have liked to trade places with you that night. That's pretty neat. Last thing, Linda, before I let you get out of here, and I appreciate the time so much, but just quickly wanted to get your thoughts on the current state of the Rangers. We know they've been in this rebuild for the last few years. A lot of ups and downs this season, but youngest roster in the league, a lot of promising young players. So what do you see when you've watched the Rangers this season?
Yeah, you know, everybody, and listen, I'm a Ranger fan, I get it, but you have to kind of temper expectations. It's really hard. We all know that being Ranger fans, but I knew, especially this year with this realigned division, the East Division is the hardest division in hockey.
Absolutely.
I knew that before they put it together. I mean, and look at it. I mean, you have to ask yourself, okay, going in, are the Rangers better than Boston? No. Are the Rangers better than Washington? No. Are the Rangers better than the Islanders? No. Are the Rangers better than either the Pittsburgh Penguins or the Philadelphia Flyers? The answer is no. So the good news for the Rangers is they're making it interesting. You know, Sunday's loss to the Penguins, that was a bad one. I mean, that, you know, kudos to the Pittsburgh Penguins. You know, that was more about the Pittsburgh Penguins having, you know, playing well, having an amazing roster. They still have Crosby and Malkin. And, you know, you have to remember that. Now, on the positive for the Rangers, so many positives. First and foremost, Adam Fox. I mean, my goodness, this guy is absolutely amazing. And even guys like Ryan Lindgren, you know, and also the guys they got in the Rick Nash trade. That has come to fruition, how that has turned out and added depth. The two goaltenders, okay, you know, a little bit up and down, but, you know, mostly up. So it's not the goaltending. Goaltending is not the reason why the Rangers are not going to make the playoffs this year. That's not an issue. The only thing that is disappointing to me, and I was excited, I have to admit, I jumped off the couch. I was like, finally, I'm texting my sister when Mika Zibanejad scored, like, just like, that's the Mika we know.
Yeah.
So you can only imagine if Mika was Mika from last year, this year, then I would, and then if the Rangers had Artemi Panarin without all this roller coaster weirdness that's going on in his life, then I would have to have different answers to the questions I just posed. Are the Rangers better than Pittsburgh? Are the Rangers better than the Flyers? Are the, you know, because then it would be a different story. But right now, as we're looking at this team now, so many positives considering what's on the roster, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Philip Hedl coming along and you know, all of this and Chris Kreider having an out of this world season and his leadership capabilities. And I'm always a big Chris Kreider fan. He, you know, I was a fan of the core group, honestly. And I still root for those players. I was rooting for McDonough when he won a cup. I continue to root for JT Miller in Vancouver, you know, real Ranger fans do that, you know, type of thing. But I miss that core group. I miss the Derek Stepans of the world, you know, but it just wasn't meant to be. So it's going to take a little more time. We didn't see the Panarin thing coming, and we certainly didn't see, you know, the Zibanejad and the COVID with him and getting back from that. But hopefully he's turned the corner. And I'm not saying it can happen, but it's really going to be tough. But I'm just glad they're making it interesting. And the, again, I'll be remiss if I don't give kudos and props to Pavel Buchnevich, because I never thought he would be the player that he is right now, which is pretty outstanding. I wasn't too sure when he first came up with the Rangers. So I'm glad to see him prove me wrong.
You hit on a lot there, but I think the overwhelming message is that the from a development standpoint, there's a lot more positives than negatives right now. And yeah, with their two best players last year were Panarin and Zibanejad. One of them isn't in the lineup, and the other one is kind of a shell of what he was last year. So all things considered, being at 10-10-3 right now, I think is a pretty good spot for them. So Linda, thank you so much. This is a lot of fun. I really, really appreciate the time. I think the fans are going to love this. And thanks again. It was great getting to chat with you and kind of go over some of these stories. So thank you for the time.
Anytime, and continue your great work, Vince. This is such greatness for Ranger fans. You keep them posted. You keep them up to date. You have great takes. People appreciate that. And we all have to stick together. So thanks.
And we're back, and a big thank you to Linda. That interview was a lot of fun. It's always pretty cool, especially given the position that I've been in for the last 2 years or so, that when you get to meet people who you've seen on TV or grew up watching or listening to in whatever way, and then you get a chance to meet them and they're super humble and friendly and very gracious with their time, it's always a great feeling. You love to see that. And Linda for sure hit on all those notes. Really fun interview. You could just see how passionate she was. Before the interview, we were kind of trying to figure out a rough time frame for how long it would last, and then we ended up going over that time. And she was like, well, it's my fault. I was really enjoying talking and going on about all this hockey talk. So thank you again to Linda. That was super cool. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And now we will dive into the Twitter questions, and we will start with Maddie Jack, who asks, given the circumstances surrounding the Rangers, do you feel their major pain point, interesting way to put it, major pain point is the age of the roster slash chemistry, or are there immediate underlying issues that can be fixed during this season? Maddie, that's a pretty good question. I think it's a thoughtful question, and it's one that I often wonder myself and talk to David Quinn and other people around the Rangers about. And, you know, to me, the biggest reason that I was expecting the Rangers to not be a playoff team this year or to probably hover around 500, to have a lot of ups and downs, is definitely the age. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You can look at a guy like Artemi Panarin and Mika Zibanejad who are in their prime, you know, Jacob Trouba. There's a few of them for sure that are in their prime, but especially given the fact that Panarin has missed 8 games and counting, it'll be 9 after Thursday. Zibanejad has been a shell of himself. Trouba missed a chunk of time. Some of those key guys have missed time. And then other younger guys like Philip Hedl have missed significant time. Kaapo Kakko has missed significant time. I mean, that alone should tell you that the Rangers being around 500 right now is almost better than you would have expected had I told you all that stuff prior to the season. But then the age itself, the other key guys on this team, Kakko, Lafreniere, Adam Fox, Ryan Lindgren, Keandre Miller, Igor Shesterkin, Julian Gauthier. I mean, you guys know the names. I'm listing off all these obvious names, but a lot of those guys are rookies or second-year players, so they are far from their primes. They are not fully finished products yet, and they're going to go through some growing pains. So that's kind of an obvious thing. But as far as the issues that can be fixed this season, I do think that there are things the Rangers need to focus on, that there are things that the Rangers need to improve on as they continue to grow into a team that they hope will contend in a few years. I think that they expect, honestly, and I had this conversation with somebody in the organization recently, that next year, I think, is really the year when they're expecting to take a step and will really not demand playoffs, but I think playoffs will be somewhat of an expectation. And in the meantime, what they need to do, and I found this interesting what Chris Kreider actually said after a game, a recent game, when I asked him a similar question. He said that he thought the team in training camp, and I wrote about this a few times during camp, was hyper-focused on improving their defense, on becoming a team that wasn't bleeding scoring chances in the way that they were last season, on being better on the forecheck, on doing more of the physical things like getting to the net and all those things that we've talked about over and over again. But the Rangers were super focused in particular on becoming a better defensive team. And what Kreider said was he felt that they became, his quote was, too structure conscious. They almost last year, where they were kind of high-flying and took a lot of risks and scored a lot of really pretty goals and ranked fifth in the league in scoring, they got away from that earlier in the season because they were trying to improve defensively, because they committed to that, because a lot of the young players on this team who maybe haven't been so good defensively traditionally are making a concerted effort to do that. We saw the defensive numbers get a lot better. We see that the Rangers have allowed fewer shots. They've given up fewer goals. But at the same time, Kreider said, I think that that did take away from our offense. The key now is finding the balance. How do you continue to have defensive success while also letting your skill, I should say, make plays and, you know, result in more goals and result in the kind of offense that we feel deep down, given the skill on this team, the Rangers are capable of. So I thought that was a really interesting comment from Chris Kreider the other day. He even in particular pointed out Alexi Lafreniere and said he took a lot of heat for not scoring a lot in his first 15 games. But I think that he was showing me both in practice and in games that he really wanted to prove that he wasn't a one-trick pony, that he could play defense at this level. And that consciousness, that commitment to trying to be a good defender, resulted in him maybe not putting up the type of points that he's capable of. So I think the Rangers are just trying to figure all this stuff out. Another big thing is the consistency and being able to close out these close games that we've seen them come out on the wrong side of a lot of the time. We just talked about that game on Tuesday night against the Penguins, where it was 3-2 late in the third period and they had all these chances to score. A little bit of that is luck. A little bit of that is running into good goaltending. But the Rangers do need to find ways to finish those games to take the next step. So I think we've been pleased for the most part with the defensive progress this season. But now they need to figure out how to play that good defense while also producing offense. And then they need to figure out how to consistently gut out, scratch and claw, figure out ways to win these close games. That to me is kind of the focus. And a lot of that stuff is just as mental, if not more mental, than it is physical. All right. Next question comes from Paul, who actually didn't have a question. Paul had a comment. And this was similar to a lot of other comments that I heard, so that's why I put this one in here. But Paul was a little harsher than some. He wrote, Brett Howden belongs in the AHL. He has belonged there since day one of his career. His time in the NHL has only hurt his development and the team. And then he goes on to blame this on David Quinn. So this has been a hot topic this week, and there's basically two points that I want to make on this. Number one is I do think that there is a very valid argument right now that Brett Howden probably shouldn't be in this lineup, especially when they're healthy. Like once Panarin comes back, and I'm writing about this for Thursday, so you guys can all read a little more in-depth my thoughts and analysis and some of the numbers that I put together to kind of lay all this out. But I do think that when this lineup is fully healthy, given what we've seen, given the lack of production from a guy like Howden in particular, and given all the depth that they have for these fourth line roles, I mean, they basically have like six guys right now that can only play in three spots on the fourth line. You've got Howden, you've got Lemieux, you've got Colin Blackwell, Phil DiGiuseppe, Kevin Rooney. So you're not going to be able to play all those guys on a given night. And most of those guys have played better than Brett Howden. There's no doubt about that. as far as what the lineup should look like moving forward once they're at full strength, I'm here to have that conversation. But with that said, very similar to the fixation on Jack Johnson earlier in the season, very similar to the fixation on Mark Staal last season, I do think that sometime, especially in the social media sphere, we tend to hone in on one or two guys and place all the blame and all the frustration for any loss that happens on one or two guys, and it's over the top. There is no way that you can convince me that Brett Howden has cost the New York Rangers any games this year. He hasn't. He hasn't. In fact, I can give you very valid reasoning for why he has been in the lineup lately, and this is what I've gotten from talking to people with the Rangers, and you guys know a lot of this stuff. Number one, the reason that he's been in, especially in the last few games when they've been making some of these tough decisions about who gets scratched, is because Philip Hedel still isn't taking faceoffs. Kevin Rooney has been playing on the third line to take the faceoffs because Philip Hedel is coming back from a hand injury and the Rangers still aren't very comfortable with him risking re-injury by taking faceoffs with that hand injury. Not to mention the fact that Hedel was at like 37% for the season before his injury. So Rooney is playing on the third line right now so that he can take faceoffs and Hedel doesn't risk re-injury. On the fourth line, that leaves Brett Howden as the obvious guy. And you know what? Brett Howden is actually the Rangers' best faceoff guy this year. He's right around 50%. Everybody else is well below 50%. So say what you will about Howden, but he has been their best faceoff guy this season. The other thing is the Rangers' penalty kill. Now, Howden, if you look at the numbers, and I'm going to dive into this in the story, his numbers on the penalty kill aren't quite as good as some of the other guys in the penalty kill. Like Mika and Booch statistically have been their best forwards on the penalty kill. But Howden and Rooney are putting up pretty decent numbers themselves. And the PK as a whole has been outstanding. They've killed like 14 or however many in a row. And I believe it's 50 out of the last 53. So there's no way that you can look at the penalty kill and tell me that anyone on the penalty kill has been bad. Because the penalty kill as a unit, as a whole, has been outstanding. So obviously the Rangers love Howden in that penalty kill role. They view him as a guy who they can see as a long-term fourth line center. I know a lot of you don't want to hear that, but they feel like that is a role that he can develop into. Somebody in the organization actually compared him at the same age. They felt like they saw a lot of the same types of skills in Brian Boyle. Some of you guys might not want to hear the same thing, but Howden has not quite the same size, but he's a pretty big kid. They like him on the PK. They like him defensively. They feel like he plays hard. They feel like he always gives the right kind of effort. They feel like he brings a little edge, and they feel like that's only coming out more and more. So these are the type of things that they like about him. And I really do think, and this is not just David Quinn. This is the misconception too. It's not just David Quinn. John Davidson, I know for a fact, is high on Brett Howden. There are other people in the organization that are high on Brett Howden. Not high on him where they think he's going to be a top six or even a top nine guy. But again, they see him as a guy that on a team that has all this skill, they want some PK, fourth line, grinding type of guys, and they are looking to develop him in that role. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think that development has gone well because I don't. But this is how they envision him. This is why they're using him. He's been good on the PK. His defensive numbers, even at even strength, are actually decent. His expected goals against per 60 is like a 2.2. That's a pretty decent number. And he's been the best guy in faceoffs, and right now they have Hedel not taking faceoffs. So those are the reasons that he's in the lineup. I've been clear with you guys that if it were my call, I would scratch him. Maybe not every night because there are other guys in that bottom six mix, like a Lemieux, for example, who I don't think have been great either. So I don't think it's an absolute no-brainer that Howden should be the scratch every single night, but I absolutely think there's a case to be made that he should be the scratch a lot of nights. But at the same time, guys, it's not like he's costing them games. It's not like he is this huge issue that is making big, glaring mistakes. It's not that he's making big, glaring mistakes. The main issue that fans have him with right now is he's not producing points. But what you need to understand is the Rangers aren't looking for him to produce points. They are never going to judge him on points. Their reason for taking him on the lineup is not going to be that they don't think he's putting up enough points. I know that's like the easiest stat to look at that everybody wants to point to. But the reason for taking him out of the lineup, I think, would be other things. top of the list would be Kevin Rooney has been better than him. Your two fourth line center options right now, once everybody's healthy, are Rooney and Howden. And my main reason for taking Howden out would be that I think Rooney has been better. I think that it is sort of becoming one of these conversations where we're hyper-focusing on one guy a little bit too much and placing blame on a fourth-line guy who's playing 10, 11 minutes, maybe 12 minutes a night, when that is not the Rangers' biggest problem. It's been a much bigger problem for the Rangers that they haven't had Artemi Panarin in the lineup. It's been a much bigger problem for the Rangers that Mika Zibanejad isn't scoring. It's been a much bigger problem for the Rangers that Igor Shesterkin is out right now and Alexander Georgiev hasn't been very good. Those are much, much bigger issues than Brett Howden. So I hear you. I get it. I definitely think that there's a case that Howden should come out of the lineup. And again, you know, I think there's a case for a few different guys. You know, this is going to be an ongoing conversation if everybody's healthy with Howden and Lemieux and DiGiuseppe and the guys that we just touched on. But right now, it's a valid conversation to have about Howden, but I don't think it should be something that we necessarily obsess over. All right. Last question comes from Anthony Ciambriello. And Anthony asks, when can we expect to see Morgan Barron up? And how long would it take for Kratsov to be in the lineup after a potential elimination? Well, Anthony, the first one, Barron, there really is no timetable, I hate to tell you. And we're talking about these decisions that the Rangers have on the fourth line right now. There really isn't a clear spot for Barron at this point. As the Rangers continue to get healthy, the forward group is only getting tighter. So I don't think the Rangers are going to bring him up just to have him on the taxi squad. I think they'd rather him continue to get consistent games with Hartford. And then if he is really blowing the doors off, and he has been productive, give him credit, but if he's really blowing the doors off, or if injuries strike with the NHL team, I think that would be a more logical time. But I don't know if they're looking at it right now, like, you know, we're going to call him up on March 25th or anything like that. I think it's kind of a fluid situation when it comes to Barron. As for Kratsov, I'm going to write about this in the next few days because I actually did make a couple calls today before the Panarin news broke. Kratsov, as we know, as we've talked about, and as Jeff Gorton told us months ago, he will be coming to New York once Tractor's season is over. They're in the playoffs right now. They're one loss away from being eliminated, although Kratsov has been good. He's got a couple goals. He's had some good games from what I understand and from the highlights that I've been able to watch. But I asked the Rangers if they had a rough estimate as to how long it would take from the moment Tractor gets eliminated to when Kratsov might be a possibility for their lineup. And the rough timetable is about 10 to 14 days. You have to think that there's visa issues for him to deal with. He has to obviously do the traveling itself to get from Russia to the U.S. Then he has to go through the COVID protocols. There is a quarantine period that he has to go through. He's going to have to get, you know, a certain amount of negative tests before he's allowed to practice with the team. I'm sure they'd want him to get a couple practices under his belt before they throw him into the lineup. So basically what I was told today was figure roughly 2 weeks from the time the Tractor gets eliminated to when you might see Kratsov in an NHL game. That too is a fluid situation, but that's a little more of a situation that we can hone in on right now because we know that, you know, once his season in the KHL is over, he will start taking the necessary steps to travel to the U.S., to go through the protocols, and to start practicing with the team. So Kratsov could be here, you know, in 2 weeks or so. We'll see. You know, Tractor could extend their season and win some playoff games and keep this thing going. But right now, my understanding is that once they're eliminated, look for 10 days on the low end, maybe 2 weeks on the high end of a rough timetable that the Rangers are looking at for Kratsov to start practicing with the team. So that's where we stand on that. Again, I'm going to write a little bit more about this Kratsov situation once we know that Tractor is eliminated, and then we can kind of speculate a little bit more and figure out how he fits and give a more precise date for this timetable. But that's what I've heard as of right now, and that's going to do it for this program. A lot of stuff to get to on this one to think. I almost recorded this earlier in the day before the Panarin news broke. I would have had to go back and record the whole thing all over. So I'm glad I waited a little bit. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I really hope you enjoyed the interview with Linda Cohn. Really, really excited that she was able to come on the show today. And we got another exciting one for you next week. I hope. We'll wait and see. But for now, I hope everybody enjoys the rest of the week. And I will talk to you guys next week.